Thanks to you all for coming, and I've been asked to welcome you here and introduce David Hunter to you. My name's Linda De Castiger, and I'm the Director of Public Health here in Greater Glasgow and Clyde, and also a member of the management team for the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. So we're delighted to have Professor David Hunter to address our seminar here this afternoon. David will be well known to many of you through his work on healthcare reform and public health policy. He is, as the flyer tells you, the Professor of Health Policy and Management at the University of Durham and also the Director of the Centre for Public Policy and Health at that same university. And he's also the Chair of the UK Public Health Association. So he comes to us with a very good range of qualifications and credibility to speak about this subject on the crisis of confidence in public health policy and practice, the search for a new paradigm. And I've been particularly interested in coming along to this session because I do think we're in a kind of crisis in public health in terms of the way we're thinking about it. If I just think of here we are in NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, and we are an organisation that calls itself a public health organisation. We have a number of transformational themes in our organisation, and one of them is that every member of our top senior management team and at every level of the organisation we should provide support and leadership to promoting public health, to improving health and to addressing health inequalities. We've also got a whole range of targets and performance indicators that are about health improvement as well as about acute services and waiting times. We've got community health partnerships whose role is meant to be addressing health and social inequalities. And yet, at this very same time, all our resources still go to the acute side. The demand for acute care is continuing to rise. And certainly, if we see problems in waiting times for the acute side, it gets a lot more attention than if we don't meet our targets for health improvement. We've also got improving economy here in Glasgow, and yet we're still seeing health inequalities, and in some cases the health inequalities are worsening. And for some of our issues, such as alcohol and obesity, they seem out of control and we're still not making the impact we want to make. So at a time like this, where the context for public health has never been better, very favourable local and national public health policy, and yet are we really making the difference in public health and health improvement? It's really important that we have this seminar today. So, David, we look forward to you inspiring us and giving us new ways of thinking and new approaches to this issue. So over to you, David.
Thank you. All right. Right, well, thank you for that introduction, Linda. Inspire wasn't the word that came to mind when I was thinking about this, but if I can inspire you and not depress you, fine. But I think in many ways maybe this is a wake-up call more than anything else, because I think Linda set the scene very well in terms of where we are and what some of the critical pressure points are in terms of shifting the paradigm and moving in a new direction in terms of public health. Anyway, thank you very much for inviting me to speak in this illustrious series. You've had some very eminent people. Clearly, you've run out of names now. But I'm delighted to be here. I never liked speaking in front of so many people I know. It's nice to be anonymous. But anyway, thank you for coming. And some of you may have heard bits and pieces or some of what I'm going to say. But hopefully, we can have some good discussion. Because, like all academics, I don't have the answers. But I hope to pose the questions and the dilemmas that we're in and maybe offer some pointers in terms of how we want to move forward. I'm very conscious that exactly a year ago, to this day, Ilona Kickbush addressed this series of lectures on the 14th of February 2006, and she was talking about global health and the public health crisis at a global level. And in many ways, what she said in that lecture and what I'm going to say are the same side, really, of the same coin, except that I don't want to be quite so global. I want to bring the issues closer to home in terms of where we are in the UK. I say the UK. I know the UK is not the UK now so much, but I think what I'm going to say travels reasonably well across the UK. But what Ilona said about public health, the crisis of public health, and the crisis of governance, I think is absolutely right, and it's that theme I want to pick up on and develop and take forward, building on what Ilona said, but applying it much more in terms of where we are in the UK, not forgetting that we're part of a global agenda. So, let me begin by just saying what the structure for this is going to be. This is my text, if you like, my keynote text. Julio Franco, we know to many of you. He's now Minister for Health in Mexico, but when he wrote this some 15 years ago, he was a Professor of Public Health in Mexico before joining WHO, and he's been around WHO for many years. But I thought this was quite a nice succinct statement of what I think the dilemma that still faces us in public health. It may have faced us in 92, but it's certainly facing us today in terms of the identity crisis, in terms of the crisis of organisation and accomplishment. Those are the key words for me in that statement. Despite the focus on collective action for health and well-being, as Linda implied, we haven't made that step change in bringing that to a reality in the way that I think in the heady days of the Ottawa Charter and Almerata and all those documents in the 70s and 80s, we thought we were heading for that step change. And here we are almost reinventing a lot of that, as I'll come on to say later. We still haven't made that step change in terms of implementation and delivery. So the structure of my talk is in three parts. First of all, why are we in crisis? And as I say, I think while that's often an abused, overused word, I think it's the word that we need to use, part of the wake-up call. Secondly, what is wrong with our present policy, governance and leadership arrangements in respect of public health? Because I do think there's a lot of dysfunctionality in these areas at the present time. And then thirdly, what might the new governance begin to look like? And that's where I'm probably at my shakiest and will probably rapidly come to a close in 40 minutes' time. Because in a sense, that's the way into the discussion, because this is not my agenda, it's all our agendas, and I'm just setting up the debate, really, with some pointers. Now, the funny thing is, we're at what I think is a sort of paradox in policy terms, where it's not always the case that public health has been high on the agenda, but it is high on the agenda now, again, for the reasons Linda said. Obesity, obesogenic environment, alcohol misuse, mental health problems on the increase. We haven't narrowed the health gap between rich and poor. That's still very much with us and widening in many respects in terms of the gradient. The income gap is still a big problem. Whatever aspect of public health one looks at, the generality is not a very happy, positive picture. There are exceptions, there are some very good things happening in little projects here and there, but in terms of the big picture, I think we have this paradox where public health is high on the agenda, but the capacity and the capability in terms of delivering on that remains incredibly weak and fragile, and we haven't made that shift, I don't think, to bring the two together into alignment where the wherewithal, the means, are up to the challenge of the ends in terms of improving the public's health. We talk the talk, but we don't walk the talk, I think is how I want to put it. Why? Well, these aren't an exhausted set of reasons, but again, you'll have your own analysis of this, but for me, increasingly, I perceive a confused and inconsistent government response to this. Now, this might be quite useful. This might be part of the crisis, but it might be also the way of beginning to get out of the crisis, because it seems to me that increasingly we have a government policy, and I'm talking fairly generally here, in relation to this tension, which is not new in public health, between the nanny state versus the enabling state. How far should the state be commanding and controlling, and how far should it be enabling, facilitating, and merely setting some loose framework and giving people advice and information, but basically allowing them to make their own decisions with government standing back. Not a new debate in public health. Comes round and round repeatedly over the decades, but I think that's a key issue still in respect of the present time. And secondly, increasingly, inconsistent policies that push and pull in different directions. It seems to me that on the one hand we're talking about encouraging partnerships. Linda mentioned community health partnerships in Scotland. We have the same kind of arrangement in England. Endless talk about collaborative working, partnership working. And yet at the same time, certainly in England, and this is suspected, is less the case here, although I suspect some of the rhetoric may be different here, not the reality, but the push in England is very much to have much more diversity, much more pluralism in the way services are organised, much more discussion around the marketisation of services, the choice agenda, all of which potentially fragment what is already a pretty complex context and makes that collaborative approach and that partnership working infinitely more difficult. So on the one hand, you've got a thrust towards partnership working. On the other hand, you've got constant organisational change, constant fiddling around with the delivery arrangements to try and get bigger bucks for your bang, or bigger bangs for your buck, rather. And that tends, I think, or maybe it is that way around, I'm not sure, but that tends, I think, to make the whole issue around partnership working that much more difficult to achieve. Equally, we have a policy which is about going upstream, keeping people healthy, preventing problems arising. On the other hand, in the healthcare sector, we have a set of policies, and again, this may be an English comment, forgive me for being anglophobic, but we have a set of policies sucking people into hospitals. Hospitals will survive in future by the amount of work they do and the amount of patients they see and the amount of ill health they treat. It's all in the interest of a hospital to have healthy people in their community. The sicker, the better, because that way you'll have beds filled and you'll have possibly more beds. So we have this disjunction, if you like, between what the policy is saying on the one hand and what the reality is on the other. Different policies saying quite different things. There is not an alignment of policies and governance that point in the same direction, which I think is part of the crisis as well. And that may be, again, functional in the long run in terms of breaking out of this cycle of despair. But at the present time, as Linda implied, we're not making much headway in the context of this confused environment and these jigsaw policies that do not cohere and do not, whatever the rhetoric may say, actually make it easy to move forward. Just an example of this. I know you have a different Prime Minister here, but Tony Blair, in one of his keynote speeches back in July last year on healthy living, I think captured this dissonance, if you like, quite well. Because if you look at that speech, which is on the number 10 Downing Street website, it's a very confused speech. On the one hand, he's saying, yeah, we want firm action by government. And he uses smoking and the smoking ban in England, which wouldn't have happened in England had you not done it here, or Ireland hadn't done it, or Wales weren't about to do it. Don't believe the government in England would have done it otherwise, because it wouldn't. But he says, I've been on a personal journey of change. I did not initially want the smoking ban. Now I do. Now I think firm government and firm action by government is desirable, is legitimate. And it may well be the same for school meals, or it may well be the same for banning junk food advertising. So he's been on a personal journey of change. But on the other hand, he's in the same speech talking about no one trusts government anymore, so we can't have the state acting as nanny. We've got to have an enabling role for government which stands back and allows people to make these individual lifestyle decisions themselves. He doesn't see individuals as being part of some collective or some community or some polity. He sees them very much as individuals making their own free choices. So I sense in that speech some tension, if you like, between what the government's role in public health should be and some lack of theoretical underpinning that gives a kind of clear conception of where the different roles of government, the individual, and communities might come. A very confused speech, which I think reflects the reality in terms of the policy agenda, as I'll come on to say. So we have this tension, familiar diagram this, we have this tension between the individual here and the community. Doesn't show up very well on the screen. On the right there. Nothing new. But instead of making that journey and actually making some progress on the community collective healthy public policy agenda, we constantly have a cycle where we go round that cycle endlessly over the years, over the decades. And I think that's part of the crisis. We accept the analysis in terms of economic social determinants being a key factor in shaping health. What we haven't been able to do is adopt organisational policy governance arrangements that make that a sustainable reality. let me pick up on a few comments our Chief Medical Officer, Liam Donaldson, made in his most recent annual report about the state of public health, because I think there's some interesting points here that have a much wider resonance beyond beyond England. But he talks about the constant raiding of public health budgets to reduce hospital deficits or meet acute care targets. Nothing new here, but the fact the CMO is saying it, who's our potential leader for public health, is interesting. Even he's not been able to avoid this happening. Secondly, lack of investment in the workforce. We still have a workforce, as I said earlier, in terms of capacity, that's unable to meet the enormity of the agenda in terms of what's required. Now, we might want to debate about what that workforce is. It's not just what happens in the health service, and it's not just what people who call themselves public health practitioners do, but there is an issue about the whole public health workforce and who calls themselves public health practitioners. And thirdly, he talks about the endless effects of reorganisation, which again in Scotland you've managed to escape from to some degree. But the interesting thing is the next quote, which I think quite nicely captures what I think is the essence of the crisis, if you like, or the disjunction between what the policy rhetoric says and what the reality is about. And he's saying here, this isn't about individuals or even groups of people, it's a systemic problem, a systemic failure to shift the mindset in terms of thinking about health in a quite different way. We still think of health as hospital-based, as bed-based. We don't really take prevention seriously. It's seen as an option, not a duty, or a right, or whatever. And I think that's quite interesting because, again, decades of talking about this agenda hasn't made any real shift in the way that our present organisations or policy systems seem to relate to that agenda. Another piece of evidence, just to explain why we're in this crisis. This is an unpublished study from the Audit Commission of a few months ago looking at Greater Manchester's health inequalities review. Manchester has, a bit like Glasgow, tremendous problems of early mortality. I think there's a difference of 7-8 years between people living in Manchester, if you're a male, than if you're living in Dorset. Not as bad as Glasgow, the gap, but still quite significant in England. And this report was quite interesting in terms of just listing what the key barriers and impediments were to thinking about tackling inequalities. No health vision, lack of champions, lack of leaders, if you like, at all levels of the system. Concerted action absence, both within the health authority but also within the whole health community in relation to Greater Manchester, in terms of those other key organisations. No overall leadership, constant reconfiguration prevents progress, management time focused on planning for and spending small amounts of money, Project Titus, you're familiar with all of that, good things happening, but at a very low level of aspiration and delivery. Lack of engagement with the voluntary sector, what we now call the third sector. And minimal use of information, lots of information around, but not much of it finding its way into decision making or into planning. And directors of public health having too wide a range of responsibilities, suffering from severe job stretch. Now, none of those things are new in themselves. We've been discussing them and looking at those sorts of issues over many years. But what's interesting, I think, is the fact that despite the policy and despite the intention of the government to tackle some of these things, we're still talking about them. We still haven't made as much progress as we should do. And that was confirmed, I think, by Derek Wanless in his second report of two to government, or at least to the UK government, in relation to public health. And you'll be familiar with that, so I won't dwell on it. But the point there is that there's still a lack of alignment of incentives in the system to focus on reducing the burden of disease. Again, the rhetoric's there, the language is there, but not the reality. So what are the problems then? And Wanless and others have documented these quite thoroughly. Capacity problems, as I've said earlier. Reorganisation, just to summarise these points. again, maybe this is more of an English problem than here, although I think you're developing that problem, I think. You've got heat or something, so the temperature's rising here. But certainly in England, you have a terror by targets culture, which is very unforgiving in terms of the blame culture that it breeds on the part of practitioners and managers. As we've said, lack of alignment between performance management, between partners, fitness for purpose, not being seen to be uppermost, and generally weak leadership. And finally, absence of effective government. So what we end up with is what, interestingly, I think, is what the former deputy CMO in England, Aidan Halligan, said in a fairly frank interview following his departure from office. He wasn't a happy bunny when he left office, and I think that's reflected in that comment. You might wonder what he was doing during this reorganisation, because he was a key part of it. And this is talking about the NHS, but I actually think there's a wider resonance here in terms of the public health agenda, because what he's saying is that despite all this fiddling around with the systems and fiddling around with the structures, we haven't really changed anything. We haven't really changed the mindset or the way doctors and nurses and others in the system think. We haven't motivated frontline staff, and the systemic dysfunctionality is still very much in evidence. And that, I think, is equally applicable to the public health system as we've constructed it. So what's wrong with policy, governance, and leadership? Well, I think there are a number of factors, and again, this isn't an exhaustive list and we can discuss these, but it seems to me that one of the problems is that we've turned our politicians into managers. And politics, and I mean party politics, governmental politics, have become managerialized increasingly. We have technocrats as politicians who think they know what it means to run and manage complex systems, and who speak the language of management without really understanding what it means, I would argue. But at the same time, we've kind of infantilized or turned managers into politicians. Management has become politicized because managers didn't do anything unless it has the sanctioning or the permission or the support of those politicians who themselves are trying to manage the system. And I don't think that relationship, which has shifted, I think, over the last 20, 25 years, is at all healthy or appropriate or functional, particularly in running complex systems, which public health is a clear example of. I've mentioned this already. I don't think, again, you run a complex system by targets. If you look at the literature on complexity, the last thing you do is set targets, particularly targets that are imposed from on high, that have no connection with the people who are responsible for managing or operating or delivering the system. And all you get, I think, is a succession of what someone called balloon squeezings. You just move the problem around. You tackle waiting lists, fine, but you just shift the problem to some other point in the system and create a balloon effect there. We aren't looking at the whole system in terms of how our actions impact on that whole system as opposed to bits of it. And I'll come back to that. But I think balloon squeezings is all we end up in doing. We just squeeze the balloon in a different place every time. And what we do, in fact, is the classic failure, which is more of the same. Let's have more management. Let's have more performance assessment. Let's have more targets. That's what the problem is. Instead of looking at a more root and branch analysis of the problem, we reach out to the familiar weapons in the armory, which have failed in the past, but we don't acknowledge that. We just think that if we do it better, or we have more of them, it'll somehow work. But we're basically bolting on these arrangements onto structures that are themselves part of the problem, not the solution. And we haven't come to that point, I think, where we have to accept that we need a new approach, a new conception of how we organise and think about these issues. And even where the talk or the language is of complexity, and a lot of the documents that one looks at, a lot of the glossies that come out of government concede the complexity of the issues, but somehow there's a mismatch between the language and the rhetoric and the actions that are then subsequently taken. We can't seem to make that bridge between the acknowledgement that this is a complex issue and the fact we need quite different tools and approaches to address those problems. And that's partly, I think, why politicians thrash around wildly. I mean, Tony Blair, when he says, oh, I'm really frustrated, I'm exasperated, public services are not changing fast enough. He's right, they're not changing fast enough. They're not able to keep up with the pace of problems that are affecting those systems. Our problems, arguably, are running ahead of our institutions to keep up with them. That's why people are burnt out. That's why managers and practitioners rush around wildly trying to cope with an endless flow of demands on them, because they're pressured by an environment that's not fit for purpose. in terms of what it is that they're supposed to be doing in a context where all the constraints and obstacles are lined up against them. And so when politicians like Tony Blair say, I want to get this system working better, he's right about that. But the tools he's using, I would suggest, are the wrong tools. They're actually going to make the problem far worse, not better. So more targets, more performance management isn't necessarily going to address the problem. We'll come back in 5 years, if that long, and say it's failed. That's probably why we've had 3 reorganisations of the health service in England since 1997. Outrageous when you think of the cost of that and the lack of progress and the lack of difference any of that's made to people on the front line, whether they're users or providers. So we have to change the paradigm of how we restructure these systems, because what we've got now just ain't working. The system is ossified, it's calcified, it's seized up in a sense. I don't think, again, government want leaders. They talk about let's have leaders, but do they know what leaders are, real leaders? I don't think so. We might want to discuss that in terms of what is the leadership challenge, because I do think we do need leaders, but I don't think that's what governments want. I think what government want are good administrators, good followers, people who will do their bidding. That point about politicians being the managers, they're the leaders, or they think they are. They don't want people who will challenge them. They want people who will deliver. And that's not what leadership's about at all. It's not about delivery. It's about changing things. It's about doing things differently. And finally, we're not dealing with a machine, but governments, politicians, because they don't understand, I think, management in a complex system, think they are dealing with a machine. They think if they twiddle with the levers and twiddle with the knobs at the centre, things will happen. In fact, they don't happen, and they're realising this now, is a great cause of puzzlement on their part. But they're not inclined to think afresh about how to change the system. They're thinking, oh, well, let's bring markets into the public sector. That'll settle it all. That'll solve it all. Let's have more privatisation. Let's bring business in. They don't think through what a different approach to public policy making might be in this sort of context. And therefore, I think the notion of the complex adaptive system, while appearing now and then in government documents, has not really shifted the mindset in a way that it needs to if we're going to get a grip on the governance and leadership issues. And that's really what I want to move on to now. Just to say briefly what a complex adaptive system is, this is a article in the BMJ some years ago in a series of complexity by Paul Plessert, one of the US gurus on complexity, and Tricia Greenhalgh, professor of primary care in London, UCL. And this is quite a nice summary of what a complex adaptive system is. Everything that government tries to control but can't, and therefore we need to acknowledge that and work with it. And that's where this kind of approach can be threatening to the kind of scientific, rational, linear approach that governments tend to subscribe to. Again, the problems are complex, and we should be using this kind of language, but governments resort to scientific management concepts that are wholly inappropriate and outmoded for this kind of way of thinking. Hence the point about targets, hence the point about thinking in silos and departments. I'll come back to that in a moment. We need to begin to shift towards this type of thinking in public policy and in governance. And at the moment, we're not. We're talking a bit about it around the edges, but it's not mainstream. This is a familiar diagram, and this is a complex adaptive system. Under present policy, it's a complex maladaptive system, I would argue, but it could be the beginnings of a way of thinking about a complex adaptive system. This is the famous Dahlgren and Whitehead diagram, which shows the individual, his or her social context in terms of the localities and the networks that they're part of, and then broadening out all those sectors around agriculture, education, work, living, unemployment, health and housing, and so on. And then the outer ring is the general social, economic, cultural environment. You're familiar with that. We might want to make it more complex by saying that arguably we're in a global ecosystem now, as that outer ring there puts it. So in a sense, we've got to extend the nation state into a much broader range of influences around the built environment, around the natural environment, climate change and so on, and around globalization issues. So if anything, the system's moved from complexity to what someone called multiplexity. But it's still a complex adaptive system. And yet we don't manage the system in any way like a complex system. We try and chunk it up into bits that can be driven through vertical silos for the most part. Now this is a notion of a public health system produced by the Institute of Medicine in the US in a report that came out a couple of years ago, which is an attempt to begin to see all these bits as interrelated. Communities, the healthcare system, employment and business, the media, academia, and governmental public health infrastructure, all of which are about the bit in the middle there, which is assuring the conditions for population health, and trying to get away from that vertical silo-driven mentality, but trying to see the public health system in some sort of holistic sense, which begins to get looked at in that holistic sense when tackling particular public health problems, whether it be obesity, mental health, alcohol, or whatever. You don't see it as coming through any one of those silos. You see it as connecting with all of them in different ways. And the definition of that system is this. A complex network of individuals and organizations that have the potential to play critical roles in creating conditions for health. They can act for health individually, but when they work together toward a health goal, they act as a system, a public health system. Not a startlingly new concept, but quite powerful in its simplicity, I think, in terms of looking at that public health system more broadly than simply through the healthcare system. So what might the new governance begin to look like? Well, it seems to me that we need to be shifting from looking at healthy institutions to looking at healthy populations. And we don't do that, I think. We're still locked up in our healthcare delivery systems, in our partnership systems, in our primary care systems. We don't look at healthy populations as the starting point and what we're trying to achieve by creating those populations and sustaining them. We train people to be health service managers, or we train them to be local authority managers or housing managers. We don't train them to be managers of health. And what we might want to think about is, how do you create a managerial epidemiology? How do you create managers, and leaders for that matter, who have as their responsibility the health of a defined population? Not the management of an institution and the health of a hospital, for example, or the health of a primary care facility, or the health of a community facility, or a housing estate, but how do you begin to broaden that focus of what managers, practitioners, and leaders should be concerned about in their localities in terms of a broader epidemiological population-based approach? Again, it's not rocket science, but we don't train managers, for the most part, to be successful in terms of looking either at healthy populations and health outcomes or at how they can contribute to creating and sustaining and nurturing that population. And again, this, I think, goes back to what increasingly in some English discussions are, and maybe here too, around the place-shaping role of local government, that health is often a feature of people's connection with place, whether it be the workplace, the place they live in, their home, their community, whatever. And the place-shaping role, which means talking about that rather than talking about health or ill health, may be the way to begin to break into this obsession with the downstream agenda by beginning to shift upstream to looking at the importance of place and people's connection with place, or places, if they have different roles and responsibilities in different places. Interestingly, we seem to be on the point where some of this is being rediscovered. Again, if you go back to those early WHO documents in the 70s and 80s around the Ottawa Charter and Alma Ata, they were full of all this discussion around health being not just what health services do, but being about what other sectors contribute to. And interestingly, the Finnish presidency of the EU, which finished in December, they had the presidency for the second half of last year, put this on the EU agenda in terms of their major health theme, that we need to think about health in a quite different way. And they coined this phrase, health in all policies. We which isn't new, but the fact it's making a bit of a comeback could be something that we begin to think about in terms of that new approach to governance and policy making. And the elements of that approach are these, that we need to think not vertically, but horizontally, in terms of contributing to the population health by looking at what goes on in other policy areas, whether it be housing, education, transport, regeneration activities, whatever. Health should be central to those. And that this approach should be complementary to traditional historical approaches to public health and healthcare services. It's not replacing or supplanting it. It's simply saying that these aren't enough. And as we've said, and as I think we probably agree, they aren't enough. We do need to do something different and better. It takes into account the health impacts of other policies when planning policies, deciding between various policy options and implementing policies in other sectors. So there's a sense in which health is at the centre of other people's agendas. It's going back a bit to the Institute of Medicine's notion of the public health system. The public health system embraces all of the policy sectors that have an impact on health, and they go way beyond healthcare departments or healthcare ministries. And finally, it aims to clarify links between policies and interventions and determinants and consequent outcomes. So in a sense, it's almost the glue that begins to put some of these policy streams and policy interventions together around the notion of health improvement. And the ultimate aim is to create evidence-based policy making. So the evidence base is still important, but you've got to see that in the context of where you're going to get the biggest payoff in terms of interventions by looking at that policy implementation issue much more broadly across government departments and ministries and levels, not just the national level, but also subnational. And this isn't just about health impact assessment, although that's clearly one of the tools we might want to use. It's about putting health at the centre of what governments seek to do, because if you look at the stewardship role of government and the literature on that, one of the key elements of stewardship is the protection of the population's health and the furtherance of that. And this way of thinking about it, which is again not new but is making a bit of a comeback, is a way of beginning to think about that. So that's really what I wanted to say. There should be another. There we are. That's my final slide. The problem in all of this is making sense of this dilemma, really, which is Rex the dog on the high wire, trying to cross it, but having this nagging thought that he's an old dog and this is a new trick. Well, in some ways it is a new trick, in some ways it isn't a new trick. It's actually a trick we just haven't pulled off yet. It's a trick that keeps coming round in the analysis of what the problem is. The hope is that we've reached a stage in the cycle of despair in public health where we can begin to say, well, we can't continue to go on as we are and we need to do something different to shift that paradigm. There are levers out there, there are tools out there. But at the moment, we're not seizing those in a way that we could to make that difference. And I suppose the issue is it a case of this being a kind of snowball in hell chance? Are we really not going to make this work? Or can we say that Rex will get across to the other side and they begin to reshape the paradigm? But it seems to me that we're at a crossroads. We're always at a crossroads in public health, but I think we're at a crossroads in public health that may be the ultimate crossroads in terms of either repeating all this history yet again or beginning to say, look, if we're serious about health in its broadest sense and health in all policies, then how do we make that a reality in terms of the systems we've got not necessarily being aligned with that agenda? And if we're not serious about that rhetoric, then fine, let's abandon it. Let's be honest about it. I don't think we've been honest at the present time that what we've got in place is actually capable of bringing about that shift, which we know is the only way to tackle some of those deep-seated, difficult, complex problems, because what we've got ain't working. And unless we acknowledge that and begin to think about what might work better, and there are possibilities and potentials, then we're not going to make any further progress than we've done over the last 15, 20 years. So the crisis could be functional or it could simply reinforce the dilemma that we face, I think, as a public health community. And my message is, can we use the crisis to break out of what we've done in the past, which is more of the same, and begin to move onto a different plane and break out of what Donald Sean called dynamic conservatism, where we simply fight like mad to stay in the same place? How do we get to a different place? Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. That was very thought-provoking and I'm sure will stimulate a lot of discussion. We've got a roving microphone here, so I'll open it up to questions for David, although maybe I'll just take the opportunity of chairing it to start. You talked about one of your suggestions was to make sure managers had responsibility for the health of a defined population rather than for a specific service. And I suppose that's exactly what we've tried to do with community health partnerships, is to give them the responsibility for the health of that local population, and yet the risk is they get drawn into service delivery and the bureaucracy of it all. How can we support them to make sure they keep that focus and try and deliver that?
Well, I think that's the dilemma about managers having been politicised and politicians having been managerialised. And if we break out of that dilemma, I don't think managers will feel that they have that support and backing to take that focus in the thinking. There's an issue for politicians here, there's an issue for communities too for that matter, and the media. I mean, as that diagram on the public health system showed, how can we create leverage in the system, not just within the system, but around the broader system in terms of getting a constituency for accepting that that's the way it should be, as opposed to seeing managers in isolation from that? How can communities, in a sense, be a kind of constituency and a support for managers in breaking out of that cycle and encouraging politicians to think that way? Because politicians would argue, well, we reflect what the population say they want, which is shorter waiting times, more access to beds, healthcare delivery stuff. And yet I'm not sure people, when they understand the issues, do want any of that, but they're not being offered anything any different. So I don't think it's seeing managers in isolation. I think it's seeing managers in a broader context, but trying to create that kind of civic dialogue, if you like, about how we can begin to change the system in which managers become a key part. But we can't expect them necessarily to be acting in isolation.
Question at the back. Can you just say who you are before you ask your question?
I'm Edward Harkins, independent consultant in community regeneration. I think really just following on from the end of your comment there, a lot of the problems and barriers you're describing tonight, you can recognise across the public sector and the quasi-public sector. And I'm thinking a particularly high-profile example just now in the Home Office, where we have a minister who describes his department as not fit for purpose.
Yep.
And his response to that is to vilify the staff and to start to micromanage the entire empire.
Yep.
I'm thinking really we've maybe been on a journey ever since the 1980s here of this political culture behind policy making, which can be quite arbitrary and can actually discount the evidence when it suits it. And it's that part of the paradigm I think we've really got to change. Thinking practically, a number of us now have been trying to work over the past year or so about trying to bring the health sector and other sectors such as regeneration closer together. And hopefully maybe get the strength of the collective there to be able to eventually go back to the politicians and say it's the entire system that doesn't work. And I would just like to hear some of your comments there about how we can try and link up the health agendas, particularly public health agendas, with what else is going on out there, economic development, community regeneration, etc.
Well, I mean, you've begun to do that, really, by what you said. I mean, it seems to me that you're not going to change whole systems overnight. You're not going to change the way people have traditionally worked overnight, but you need to find, I think, kindred spirits or people who are capable of embarking on that journey and working with them. There's no magic solution or panacea. I mean, you're right to say that this problem in government is not confined to health. It's, as you say, evident in all major departments. It's evident in education, it's evident in the Home Office, in the criminal justice system, in the prison service. All of these services are incapable of delivering on the agendas they've got because they've been compartmentalised in a way that doesn't make sense of the problem in terms of how it should be tackled. Moreover, it seems to me that we've got the government, as I said earlier, who don't seem to know what to do about that, other than simply to resort to the same old weapons and tricks and levers. And that's what's problematic. So I think you've got to, at a local level or intermediate level, work with who you can, whether it be in local government or the police or the fire service or housing departments. I don't think one necessarily needs to be thinking about conventional public health people in this regard. You need to pick up whoever shares, in a sense, that way of thinking about the problem. Because otherwise, if we don't have what someone called boundaries, people who can work across the boundaries of organisations, we're going to continually be locked into our own organisations and not make that connection across the piece. So we need to be looking for people, whether it be leaders at different levels of the system, who can make that transition across their sector into thinking about other sectors and how they can contribute to this agenda. And over time, hopefully, there'll be enough of those people to get that step change in delivery. But the worry is that these problems that we're confronting are pretty immense and they're pretty serious. They're not going to go away. I mean, obesity is a huge problem. We're not doing anything about it, really. We're fiddling at the edges. Climate change, we're barely discussing sensibly. It seems to me that, time's not on our side. If that's the crisis bit, then how do we get that step change happening a bit more quickly? Because we can all point to the innovative project, the innovative initiative, but none of that tends to get mainstreamed. The innovation has to go on within our organisations, not alongside them. Too often we see the innovation or the pilot scheme as being out there, instead of being inside what we're doing in our day job. You know, it's the bit we do on the side or the bit we fund someone to do for 3 years. Why aren't we doing that innovation and that constant rethinking and that constant learning all the time in our day jobs? We don't.
Andrew. Thank you. Andrew Tannehill, Head of Evidence for Acting with Health Scotland. You recurrently referred to something that's at the heart of your presentation, and that is the complexity of the system. Mm. Part of that complexity is to do with issues in acute care, modern day issues in healthcare, and the need to try to get services that are as local as possible and as national as necessary. There are new threats and re-emergent threats to health that have important implications for acute care capacity. And there is public accountability, and the public can be, in an exaggerated way, people refer to it as wanting a casualty department in the back of their house, preferably with a CAT scanner. Now, I emphasise that's a caricature, but it's a caricature of a point which is understandably that people want as good access to as many acute care facilities as they can have. Now, these are part of the public health debate, because the public health debate has to be about how to provide healthcare services as well. I think the question is, how can we put them properly into the wider context of an even more complex public health system? And when it comes to trying to get that kind of change, I can't help thinking whether the best way to get Rex across that wire rather than falling off is to tell him he's in a crisis up there and kick him.
You're right, Andrew. I mean, there's a number of issues there. I mean, one might want to pose the question, why should public health be so concerned with what happens in the healthcare delivery system? And I think some of that's historical in terms of what happened in 1974 when public health came out of local government and went into the NHS. And arguably, many would argue, and some of this has been documented, lost its way in respect to focusing too much on that downstream healthcare agenda, which is not irrelevant. I accept it has a key role to play in public health terms, and arguably we're not doing enough in healthcare about public health or prevention in terms of secondary prevention. But I'm not sure we shouldn't be turning the problem around or the issue around and saying that we can't go on as we are because we're not going to be able to sustain funding on healthcare services if we simply continue to invest in healthcare when a new technique or a new intervention or a new drug comes along, that in a sense, systems will become unaffordable, not just ours, but all systems across the world that are publicly funded will become unaffordable. That is the reality. The modelling that's been done shows that within 5, 10, 15 years, all social insurance, tax-based systems will simply become unaffordable unless they're radically restructured or radically rethought in terms of both the pressures on them and also how they themselves are currently organised, which is part of the debate that's happening in the UK now, I think, around hospitals and how many we need and where they should be sited and what kinds we need and so on. Although if we'd had that debate 5 years ago, we wouldn't have put a lot of private finance initiative money into locking ourselves into 25, 30-year systems that are going to be outmoded within the next 5 years. I think public health has to... It can't stand back entirely from that debate, but I think it has to present the business case for saying, in a way that maybe it hasn't done, that because we can't go on like that, we do have to begin to think about how we get a different fix on this dilemma of people constantly wanting the bed or the drug or the treatment that's suddenly come on the market, but that not being the answer in the long run, because it won't be. I mean, stomach obesity cannot be solved by stapling people's stomachs. It might get you the quick fix, but it won't get you the long-run payoff, which has to come from a preventive approach. And maybe we're not taking people with us in this discussion. And maybe we're having this discussion too much within health systems narrowly defined. We need to broaden the debate and broaden the discourse. I'm not sure we're doing that. And I'm not sure we have the people who are capable of making that connection with the different stakeholders that have to be part of this discussion. I think we're still having this discussion around the board table or around the community health partnership, and that's fine, but it needs to be a much bigger discussion, and it doesn't seem to me we're having that discussion at that level. And it's the same with prisons and the criminal justice system. We're not having that big discussion about what it is that's creating this block in prisons, because we shouldn't be putting all these people in prisons if we know that prisons don't work, and most people accept prisons don't work, and yet we still build prisons and put people into them. What is it about the systems we have and the inability to stand back from them and say, this ain't working, this is broke, we've got to have a new conception of thinking about the problem here? Public health needs to, I think, be in the vanguard of that debate and that discussion, and it's not at the moment. It's too timid or too frightened or too locked into a healthcare agenda, which I think is... not the agenda should be debating on, really.
Lucy?
I'm not sure if I heard you correctly using a word boundaroid. I hadn't heard that before, but I think I may be one. I'm Lucy Reynolds, and I work 3 days a week in clinical paediatrics and 2 days in child public health.
All right.
And I wondered about your... You emphasised the importance of the media and whether you have any plan for a way forward in influencing them. I'm thinking of an example in paediatrics of the years that we've lost in terms of moving forward in autism and research into autism and so on, because of the way that the media, in the interests of balanced journalism, would, for instance, on the Today programme, put the same amount of time to somebody presenting a study of 1 million children and that there was no link between MMR and autism, and somebody, I think it was Carol Vorderman, who believed that her childhood, the MMR had caused autism. And when people listen to that, it's much easier to listen to Carol Vorderman than it is to somebody quoting statistics. So we know that, you know, the balanced journalism is actually adversely affecting public health. What can we do about it?
Take Carol to one side. I don't know, I don't have the answers. I mean, maybe some of you do, but you're right, and that is the problem. So how do you deal with it? Do you take Carol to one side? Do you get hold of people, celebs or whoever, to make the case, like Jamie Oliver did for school dinners in England anyway? You didn't need him here. You were doing it already. But I mean, yeah, the media's very difficult and probably impossible to tackle in terms of there being a simple solution to that problem. All one can do, I think, is constantly try and put the other view, get the other view into some sort of public domain that is meaningful. It's not just the media now, too. I mean, it's the internet. People can pick up what they want from the internet, whether it's been validated or not. So, I mean, if they miss Carol, they can go on the internet and get all sorts of weird advice about things, which are not entirely appropriate either. So, like the GP who's been giving weird advice on the internet, apparently. So, you know, we live in a very pluralistic, diverse society now, where people can get advice from God knows how many thousands of sources. It's difficult. It's difficult. I don't know the answer.
It's just coming. I'm Claire Blanchard from University of Glasgow Public Health Department.
I'm just wondering if, you know, taking those discussions to more international dimensions and maybe, you know, getting in touch with people from Sweden or, you know, where the public health system is much better, would be one of the solutions, not solutions, but way of trying to think of new dimensions to our public health department. Plus, it would give a much more homogenous way of dealing with things, especially when it comes to climate change, which is a global issue. You know, and I think tackling this in a much more homogenous manner globally would help extremely.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think particularly in Scotland, you're well placed in many ways to link up with some of the smaller countries in Europe, like Finland, like Norway, who are in many ways thinking about these issues in a quite different way, or Sweden even. I mean, if you look at these countries, they don't tend to have gone down this very narrow target-driven road. They're much more concerned about values and starting with values and what is it as a society we want to subscribe to or move towards or improve. And the view is that targets can't capture that. They don't work anyway, or they're too limited, or you immediately narrow the problem down to what's measurable. And that may not be the issue. So having a value-based approach could be another way of looking at the whole area. And there are countries that Scotland, I would have thought, given that it wants to be different from England anyway, might begin to connect with. So you have a network, even of regions or small countries, small nations within Europe that can, in a sense, support and reinforce and learn from each other. Because all of this is a learning situation. It seems to me there's no end point here. When governments say, let's solve the problem, let's have the perfect structure, which they're saying now about the NHS, and we all know it's not the perfect structure. We all know there'll be another reorganisation in 3 years' time, as there have been 14 since 74. So it's not ever going to be the end of the road. We're on a journey, and that journey will continue. And all we can do is make little indents on that journey, and hopefully incremental steps along that journey. But the whole thinking about complexity science and complexity approaches that you constantly plan, do, study at, you reiterate, you learn as you go. What works, you build on. What doesn't work, you reject. You think about something else. Our systems don't do that. They're ossified. We just look up to government. We wait for the mantle to be laid upon us in terms of what we should be doing. And then we do it, because that's what ministers want us to do. We can't go on like that. And I get a sense that that's worse in this country than some other European countries. I think the problem is probably universal, but it's particularly acute, I think, in our system of governance at the present time in the UK. Again, maybe post-devolution, Scotland and Wales can begin to move away from that dysfunctionality, but it doesn't seem to me at the moment we've been able to do that in a way that maybe other countries, particularly the Scandic countries, have managed to do. So your point's a good one.
I'm Kay Barton, I'm Scottish Executive Health Department. Following on from that, because I think we're beginning to talk about managing and improving performance, but you talked about terror by targets, and that's a particularly NHS thing here. How do you think we can aim for a healthier performance improvement, maybe, rather than performance management culture, that spans both the NHS and the other players, the other key players?
Well, I think some targets are good. I don't think all targets are bad. I think targets work where you have people engaged in the setting of those targets and engaged in the ownership of them, and that are focused on outcomes, not on means. I think many of our targets are too focused on means, and they're handed down from on high, and they're not constructed with the input of those who perhaps... Well, at the end of the day, have to be relied upon to make the target work. So, again, it's not difficult stuff, but we haven't been very good at doing that. We've tended, despite, again, the rhetoric, to impose targets, whether they be punitive or not. They're not connecting with anything that people themselves on the ground feel they've contributed to. So you need to turn it around, in a sense, and say to people, what is it you want to achieve and how can we do it? And then back them in that regard. And we don't do that. We tend to feel somehow that someone at some other level knows best. And all that happens then is you get dysfunctional behaviour. Sure, you can meet the target, but you probably gamed the system or cheated to do that. Because we don't tolerate failure, which is the other problem of targets. If you're going to have targets, you've got to accept that people might fail. Failure, people will not fail. They'll cheat rather than fail. Hence the terror bit. But I mean, it doesn't matter how well-meaning you are, I think you have to bring people with you in constructing that target and that set of objectives, and it should be around about outcomes rather than means of getting there. So when we talk endlessly about waiting lists and waiting times, it seems to me that's maybe the wrong debate. We should be talking about health outcomes as the target. That's what Andrew going.
One of the reasons that targets are often not health outcome targets is because it can be extremely difficult to link with any confidence a particular measure or set of actions with the outcome target. And arguably some of the worst targets that you can have are the ones that are the highest level outcomes, where you then can't construct a logic model that will take you there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would.
Hi, Mary Gilhooly, Professor of Gerontology at Brunel. I was sitting here thinking about what was the point of having a healthy population. And of course, the point used to be that you had to have healthy workers so you could have a rich country, or you had to have healthy soldiers so that, you know, if you went to war. Of course, we don't need these things anymore. We can bomb people from the sky and, you know, perhaps we do need healthier workers because they have to now work till they're 67 or 105. But of course, the other target for a healthy population might be that humans could all live to be 125. But of course, the problem is the government doesn't want people to live into advanced old age because they can't afford the pensions. And, you know, whenever I tell people that it suits the government to have people smoke and drink and be fat and preferably be healthy enough to work till 67 and then promptly drop dead so they don't have to pay the pensions. And I'm just not convinced that we don't take this whole stuff about, you know, healthy populations and health promotion seriously, because we're afraid that people will live a long, long time and we won't have any way to pay their pensions. Do you have any comments on these views, David?
I don't think governments are that cynical, are they? Or that clever?
I think they are.
To make those connections. I think that's too joined up for most governments. Yes, well, it depends who you speak to, doesn't it? I mean, in my neck of the woods, we have Tom Kirkwood at Newcastle, who heads up the Ageing Institute there, who thinks all this frailty issue about ageing is... negative talk that needn't be the case at all. People can age healthily right up to the very end and can be productive up to the very end and have a very short, compressed period of ill health, whereas you say they then pop their clogs quite rapidly and neatly. That may not be the reality we've got now, but it may be one scenario, I don't know. But I'm not sure we should be talking about length of life, it's quality of life. So I would say when we talk about health outcomes and health and population, we're talking about the quality of life, not just the length of life. And as you say, if we're going to live into old age, it's got to be a healthy life to make it worthwhile. What people then do and what they're used for depends what economy we're in. But it seems to me that in many of the areas where we could do with more people, they aren't there. We're bringing them in from Eastern Europe now. And we clearly have real problems of... servicing some of our caring sectors in particular. Maybe because we don't value the jobs in those sectors, maybe we don't train people appropriately, I don't know. But it seems to me that we need to be thinking about that much more imaginatively than we are doing. And I would have thought for that we do need healthy people who live a long, healthy life. And, well, as I say, that may be one way of looking at it rather than being quite so cynical as you are, Mary.
The package of, sorry, Peter Craig from the Chief Scientist's Office in the Scottish Executive Health Department, the package of measures you summarised under the heading of health in all policies seemed ultimately to rely very heavily on good evidence. One that's famously concluded that most of the evidence we need for improved population health is actually lacking. You think we're doing the right things to get the evidence that we need, and do you think the recent Cooksey review will help or hinder us in this effort?
That is an issue, Peter, and certainly the Cooksey review, I think, was as Wanless was very keen to emphasise the importance of translational research and the fact that we do have a lot of research, but it's often not connecting with practice. Because the incentive structure for academia tends to be rather different at the present time from the one that might better engage with policymakers and managers and practitioners. I think there's a bit of a disjunction then between what academics get judged on and what might be ultimately valuable. Some academics can do both, but some academics find it difficult to see the value of what they're doing in research terms in terms of how it might change and affect practice. So I'm not sure the problem is whether there's a deficit of good research. I'm sure there is a deficit of good research, but I'm not sure whether that's the totality of the problem, or whether the problem is actually we're not making best use of what research we have in a way that can be used by people on the ground in a way that might be meaningful and accessible to them. And that may be a role for researcher, there may be a role for somebody else to actually make that translational, that knowledge transfer connection between the two camps. So I'm sure we could do with more investment in public health research, which has been very poor until recently, where there's at least an attempt now to put a bit more money into that area. But it's peanuts compared with what was into medical care research. So again, it's part of the problem, I think, that if we're serious about public health, we need to invest much more heavily in the research infrastructure. Not just research, but the infrastructure for research, which is very weak in this country. But I do think research that we have that just doesn't get used. And that's partly, I think, around, well, it's the point earlier, you know, we have public health observatories in England. We've got one in every region, 10 public health observatories, pouring out information, access to big databases. People aren't using these sources. There's something about people's ability to use the information when they've got it, never mind saying what they haven't got. So as well as there being a need for more research, there's also a need to make sure that we connect people to that research in a way that they can make best use of it. Practitioner-based evidence as well as evidence-based practice, I think.
Maybe having asked the first question, I can get the privilege of the last one. You talked a lot in your presentation about leadership of public health, and I guess I've always taken the view that you work within the system and provide your leadership there. But some of what you're saying is that we really need to challenge that system and be quite radical and not just accept the status quo. I don't know if there's many people here who are leaders in public health. Is there any kind of final word of advice you would give us about that balance?
It's both, but I think leadership ultimately is about challenge. It's not about threats. It's not about making people feel uncomfortable necessarily, but it's about raising what the potential and possibilities might be of thinking about things in a different way. It seems to me good management and good administration is what we've got now, if we're lucky, and what we don't have, I think, is enough leadership. And it isn't about control. If one can use a military analogy, the military would argue, because they work in complex situations, they have command but not control. Command's not bad, control is possibly bad. What we need are leaders who can command and who therefore begin to challenge the environment that people are managing and administering within. I think also leaders develop staff through education, not through training. Again, we're obsessed with competencies and criteria for successful workforce development. We don't educate people, we train people. In a complex system, you need people who are educated, not trained, because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, and you're training people for something that's happening yesterday or today, not tomorrow. What you want to do, I think, is develop people for what may happen tomorrow that we can't predict today, and therefore you want education, not training. And good leaders, I think, acknowledge that, and we don't do that. So leadership is, I think, about looking at the fact that where we are now isn't where we're going to be tomorrow, so how can we begin to think about tomorrow in a different way? And as I say, managers, politicians find that kind of thinking often uncomfortable because it challenges the way things are done. And the way things are done, as I would argue, is why we're in the crisis we're in.
Thanks. Well, we'll be able to carry on some of this conversation. There's drinks next door. But just before we finish, Andrew, do you want to say something about the next seminar?
Yeah, thanks very much, Linda. Our next scheduled event, folks, is on the 3rd of April when we have Rajiv Kumar coming to lecture. Rajiv is the Chief Executive of the Indian Council for International Economic Relations, and he's recently been working with the President of India on India's stance in relation to globalisation. So he's going to come and talk about economics and ethics, which I think is central to our purpose. In addition to that, we're also trying to squeeze in an extra lecture, and we haven't quite managed to pull it off yet. So this is pencil this in your diaries. We're hoping that on the 13th of March, someone called Geoffrey Wigand will be coming to lecture us on his experience of blowing the whistle on tobacco companies in the States in the 1990s. He is the executive, research executive, who was in a long and protracted battle with Brown and Williamson in the United States about the relationship with between tobacco, smoke and cancer. So that's the 13th of March, possibly, and we'll let you know about that. Keep your eye on the website. And the 3rd of April, definitely, with Rajiv Kumar. Thank you very much.